For us this morning is United States v. Trent, 17-6041. Counsel for appellant, if you would make your appearance.
May it please the Court. My name is Howard Pincus from the Federal Public Defender, and I represent Richard Trent. The Supreme Court in Mathis changed this circuit's law not only as to its primary holding in Mr. Trent's direct appeal as to the meaning of an element, but also as to its alternative holding. Under Mathis and what this Court said in Mr. Trent's direct appeal about the general Oklahoma conspiracy statute, Mr. Trent was convicted under an indivisible statute. Because that statute reaches more than drug crimes, and because Mathis is not a new rule, Mr. Trent was improperly sentenced under the ACCA, and he's entitled to relief. Mathis held under a long line of cases that what matters in determining whether a predicate crime is an ACCA predicate are the elements. As this Court recognized in Titties, Mathis abrogated the primary holding in Trent as to what the meaning of an element is. Mathis also held that under using the demand for certainty that traces back to United States versus Taylor, that only if it could be said with certainty that a statute has alternative elements is it divisible.
Well, how did that abrogate circuit law?
Well, it abrogated what this Court applied in Trent.
Well, that wasn't the question. The question is, this certainty requirement goes back to Taylor. I mean, it goes back to 1990. Mathis wasn't purporting to change anything in its discussion of that, was it?
Well, it wasn't purporting to change anything in any part of its opinion.
Then the answer to that question is yes. And Mathis refers to the discussion in Trent relating to its first rationale.
Correct.
And saying that it didn't agree with that, but it didn't say anything about the alternative.
Well, what it says is when you have to make a threshold.
No, that's not the question.
Okay.
It didn't say anything about Trent's alternative rationale.
Oh,
correct?
If you're saying did Mathis specifically say it was abrogating that aspect of Trent? No.
Okay. And circuit law relative to certainty has been the same over time since Taylor, hasn't it?
It has been with respect to once a statute is divisible and you apply the modified categorical approach, in that situation, how certain the record documents have to be to show which element set somebody is convicted
under. We've cited to the certainty standard in cases leading up to and before Trent was decided, correct?
Not in this specific context.
What about Huizar? What about the U.S. v.
Huizar says that wasn't even at issue whether the statute was divisible or not.
Yeah.
And it was going to assume without deciding that it was divisible and was applying the modified categorical
approach. Let me just
tell
you what the problem I'm having with your argument. You may disagree with the way Trent handled that alternative analysis, but it wasn't purporting to change any circuit law. It was applying it as the Court understood it. And if it was, we can argue whether it was right or wrong, but can we really change it at this point? Why isn't this law of the case?
It was purporting to apply circuit law. It didn't actually cite anything about the level of certainty
and
required.
And why isn't it law of the case?
Well, because what it applied in its discussion was not the demand for certainty that Taylor and Mathis requires in determining specifically Mathis, whether the statute is divisible in the first place.
Yeah, but it seems like you want to relitigate that issue in the context of the direct appeal. But the direct appeal is over. And how can we go back and revisit that at this point?
Because if you look at what this Court said in Trent, in its alternative holding, it was very clear that it was not applying the demand for certainty in deciding the divisibility.
No, I understand that, but it's the law of the case, and if we and how can we get around that? What's the exception to the law of the case doctrine that would allow us to do that?
The exception is that Mathis has changed this circuit's law, and that law is reflected in Trent.
How has it changed the circuit's law?
Well, I don't see any case where this Court has said that in the divisibility context, In deciding the threshold question of divisibility, it applies a demand for certainty. And Trent certainly did it. So the law, as reflected in Trent, is not the demand for certainty that Mathis requires.
Did you see any cases where we didn't say that certainty was required in this context? I didn't find any either way.
No.
So and I guess that, I'm not so sure how it's clear that there was an intervening change in the law with respect to certainty.
Well, because if you look at
what's happening in this case, basically.
Right. If you look at the direct appeal in Trent, it did not apply the demand for certainty. It looked at the Oklahoma general conspiracy statute. It said there was no Oklahoma court decision that explicitly decided the issue of whether it was an element and whether the jury had to find the object of the conspiracy beyond a reasonable doubt. It looked at case law going back a century in Oklahoma, and it said it was suggestive that the object is an element. It then looked at the jury instructions as well and said, when combining that with the case law, it appears that Oklahoma requires that.
Yeah, but when it reached its ultimate conclusion, it said, we conclude that even if the Supreme Court was using the term elements in a traditional sense, Oklahoma conspiracy is divisible. It was pretty direct and pretty clear when it reached its ultimate conclusion.
Oh, it certainly reached that ultimate conclusion, and we're not disputing that. What we're disputing is what standard it applied to divisibility. Well, we're saying that the standard that was applied to divisibility was not the certainty standard that Mathis
but requires. You glean that from its use of language like appears and that sort of language. It didn't reject this demand for certainty that was in Taylor and that existed in Shepard. It didn't reject anything explicitly, did it?
No, it did not do that. But it didn't say we're certain of this. It didn't say we have to be certain
of this. Its conclusion is pretty darn certain.
Well, it looks at what appears and what's suggested, and then, to top it off, it looks at Richardson as support for its conclusion. It wouldn't need support for that conclusion if Oklahoma law spoke with certainty. And that's what Taylor says we have to have, and what Mathis says we have to have.
Let me ask you this. I refresh my memory. In your reply brief, do you even address the law of the case argument that's being made by the government here?
Well, I understand the law of the case argument.
No. That's not my question. It's pretty significant. If you're not going to respond in your brief to their specific argument and give us what, and maybe I'm not recalling correctly, but there are exceptions. That's what we're talking about here. One has to respond and directly address those exceptions. Did you do that?
Well,
simple question.
I believe so. What we said all along in our briefing is an intervening change in the law gets you around law of the case. And that's what we argued in our opening brief. And that's our position, that it's the intervening change in the law reflected in Mathis of the demand for certainty being applied to the threshold question of divisibility. Yes, this court has, of course, applied the demand for certainty when looking at whether the record documents showed which element set somebody was convicted under.
So let me just make sure I understand. You're not saying that Mathis created an intervening change in Supreme Court law.
No.
You're saying that it said something that is somehow in tension with what the alternative rationale in the Trent direct appeal.
Well, it's totally inconsistent with the alternative rationale. It requires certainty, and this court didn't apply certainty.
Wait a minute.
Go ahead.
You said, in response to the first question, you said that you're not saying it affected a change in Supreme Court law.
Correct.
Well, if Mathis is now applying that Taylor certainty to the divisibility question, is that not a change?
It's dictated by prior precedent. It is not a new rule.
Okay.
It may be new for this circuit's case law, just as Mathis changes this circuit's case law on the elements question, but it's still dictated by prior precedent. Justice Kagan was very clear that it was breaking no new ground in Mathis itself, that all of this was dictated by Taylor and Shepard and a long line of cases going back 25 years.
Okay, so then let me play it out. Mathis is dictated by precedent. It's application of the Taylor certainty principle to divisibility is dictated by prior precedent. Would it then be your argument that it's just that in this instance, in Trent, its alternative analysis did not adhere with this principle that was intervening as to us, this Supreme Court principle as to us?
Yes.
And how can it be intervening as to us and not be breaking new ground?
In the same way that it's intervening as to this court with respect to what is an element, whether, you know, the means versus elements distinction that clearly abrogated Trent and that clearly was not based on new law in the Supreme Court. This circuit issued its opinion in Trent about what means versus elements are. The Supreme Court said, no, that was wrong as to means versus elements, and it's been wrong since Taylor and Shepard. It's not a new rule. It's dictated by prior precedent. It's dictated by prior Supreme Court precedent, and this court misapplied that precedent in Trent. We're arguing the same thing here as to the alternative.
But the point would be, okay, we have from Mathis telling us that Trent 1's initial analysis was incorrect. Fine, we have that. But it was applying settled law. Well, if Trent 2 had before, I mean, not Trent, no, if the alternative analysis in Trent 1 had before it this landscape of law, okay, and then got it wrong, why aren't we stuck with it getting it wrong? Because if Mathis is not breaking new law, then in the playing out this legal fiction, then that alternative analysis was done under the rubric of that existing law, and then that alternative analysis is just wrong.
But by that logic, the alternative analysis, the initial analysis, would be wrong too, even though it was dictated by prior Supreme Court precedent. It's the fact that it's breaking no new ground as to Supreme Court precedent. It's intervening because it changes this court's law, but it does it in a way that's not a new rule.
Well, wouldn't your argument for an exception to the law of the case doctrine better fit? I think there's three exceptions, and you're relying on the intervening change, but wouldn't it better fit the clearly erroneous exception? Isn't that what you're really arguing?
Well, I'm happy to take both.
You haven't done it, but I'm not seeing that argument anywhere either.
No, we didn't make that argument. I think it is an intervening Supreme Court decision that changes this circuit's law, and it's not a new rule, and that's the critical thing. Something can be dictated by prior precedent, and yet this court have misapplied that precedent.
But that's exactly the point. Misapplied is basically what your argument is. It seems to me that it's a different prong of the law of the case, because what we're talking about here is that when Trent 1 made its alternative analysis, it had before it the law. The law that exists, the law that was pronounced by Mathis, hasn't changed anything, so it had before it, in theory, that law, and then it got it wrong. So the question then becomes, as in many of our cases, we could have a panel do something wrong. The question is, can we get out from under it? And that's different than the question of whether it's intervening, because you're saying that it was the law.
Well, I mean, to me, if it was intervening as to the primary holding in Trent, because it's dictated by Shepard and Taylor and that line of cases, and all of Mathis is dictated by
the primary holding of Trent was wrong. Let me add.
That's the argument here, that it was wrong under Supreme Court law going back to Taylor, Shepard, and there isn't a lot of law in this circuit, or really any law in this circuit, about the certainty required. It's Trent saying it appears, it's suggestive with what Richardson says about the CCE that supports our conclusion. None of that is the demand for certainty that Mathis requires based on Trent and Shepard.
Getting to that very last issue, which is divisibility, and assuming we bite off on the idea that the certainty aspect of Mathis was an intervening change in the law of this circuit as well, mm-hmm. and we reconsider, why can't we, using the same analysis, essentially, plus what we now have from Mathis, why can't we say with certainty that it was divisible?
A panel of this court has already said That wasn't certain, effectively. It said but we're now what looking appears, at it. What's suggestive. We're relying on those.
We had case law. And putting aside our language in Trent 1, putting aside that language, if we're looking at the issue fresh now, why can't we decide with certainty? What's your best argument this
court
isn't
I think
certain?
We are. This court is bound by what the brute facts that the court in Trent 1 said. And I'm going to try to reserve my remaining 12 seconds.
Well, we didn't even realize that it's not clear that we even understood that certainty was an issue there.
No, but it had this. The panel in Trent had every incentive to read Oklahoma law to reach the holding that it did, to read it fairly, but if it was certain, it would have said so, and it wasn't. Thank you.
May it please the Court, my name is Tim Ogilvie, Assistant U.S. Attorney, appearing this morning on behalf of the United States. There's one phrase in the defendant's opening brief that I suggest puts the issues before the Court today in very high relief, and that statement is this. To be sure, before Mathis, this defendant could not obtain relief. So the next question is, what has Mathis now added to the calculus that was not present before the Court in Mr. Trent's direct appeal? And the answer to that is nothing. It changed nothing about the court's alternative analysis and changed nothing as to the certainty requirement. Mathis only used the term Taylor's demand for certainty, and that's a case that's now been around 25 years. There is nothing about what Mathis said about how certain the court needs to be that changes really anything about the Trent analysis.
What case law supports, though, that despite that, the Supreme Court now saying that certainty has been the law for 25 years, what case law supports that we were aware of that, particularly considering the language that we used here in our alternative analysis, which certainly didn't use the word certain?
Your Honor, I'd suggest there are basically two approaches to that. One is Taylor itself said the term certainty really means can we tell what crime with what elements this defendant was convicted of. The other part of Your Honor's question has to do with application of what we now know of as the Mathis tools for answering that question. And Your Honor, to follow up on one of Your Honor's questions of Mr. Pincus, if we were to look at this question anew today, I suggest the court's analysis would be exactly like the Trent direct appeal alternative analysis. It correctly used the Mathis tools, and there's nothing about the way in which that was done that suggests that the court was unsure.
Well, it did go outside of the Mathis tools. I think it looked at the federal statute, conspiracy statute, didn't it? I mean, it did. Some of that analysis would not be appropriate under the Mathis standards.
That may be true. It did rely or at least found some support in a federal case, mm-hmm. but the remaining Mathis tools, which were the primary reliance or the tools upon which that panel primarily relied, was exactly like the Mathis tools. First, it looked at the language of the statute. It looked to see what decisions from the Oklahoma's highest court on this issue would have been, looked at permissible documents like, well, what did the jury instructions say and suggest? And I believe that the fact that the court used language like this suggests or this appears is not a statement of reticence or uncertainty by the Mathis or the Trent panel. It's rather an acknowledgement of this court's duty where there's not any explicit decision from a state's high court that it's called upon to exercise those tools to try to predict. And it's ordinarily not this court's call to say, here is definitively what the law of the state
counsel,
is.
Counsel, it doesn't seem that Mr. Pincus is quarreling about the use of the tools, but more what you were just talking about, some of the tentative language. So what does this certainty standard actually require in a Mathis analysis?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure I've ever found a case where it actually defines the quantum of proof we have to be certain beyond a reasonable doubt or by a preponderance of the evidence. The language of Taylor just says, can we be sure from looking at what we're supposed to look at? And the answer here was, yes, we can. And another clue is found in Mathis where it said, the kind of indeterminacy that Mr. Pincus now argues on behalf of his client should be a very, very rare occurrence, and it should be the exception rather than the rule. And I think that's the Supreme Court telling all of the rest of us that these tools exist, the answer may be divined, and his argument seems to be it was not done with the required certainty. But to get back to a point earlier by Your Honor, there's nothing about Mathis that changed what we understand of as certainty. We go back to Taylor that just says, are we able to tell from the records we're allowed to look at what happened? And the answer here is yes.
And it doesn't change the overarching standard of proof, right? I mean, in these sentencing contexts, aren't we looking at a preponderance?
Well, that's true. In fact, in some respects, changed very little.
So the question is, are we certain by more likely than not, right? More probable than not?
Well, I think that's probably entirely accurate. And I would suggest that if this court, again, to get back to Judge Moritz's question, what if we looked at this brand new today, ignoring the law of the case for a moment, I suggest that the court, with some insignificant exceptions, would probably analyze this issue exactly like the Trent panel did in its alternative analysis. Ultimately, this court should affirm because Mr. Trent already got what he asked for today, which is an elements-based examination of the prior conviction that's at issue here.
Counselor, are you still pressing your timeliness argument?
Your Honor, I have, but I will have to admit that it is less critical in this case than it is in a lot of cases. The district court found that it was untimely. There are reasons to think that. But I suggest that the law of the case doctrine in this case is so clear that it's the kind of case where reaching the merits is probably easier than resolving the procedural issue of timeliness. So while I do continue to press it, I will have to acknowledge that under the circumstances of this case, the district court's logic and the Trent panel's logic and its alternative analysis, it's far less critical here than it might otherwise be. So I'm happy to try to field questions from the court if there are any, and if not, I think I'll conclude by saying that primarily for the law of the case doctrine, affirmance is warranted, and even if not, and this court were to look at this issue anew, it would reach exactly the same conclusion under exactly the same logic as the Trent Direct Appeals alternative analysis. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Case is submitted. Thank you, counsel, for the good arguments.